Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
I'm very excited on this episode of Soul by Todd Richards to have one of my closest and dearest friends. I know I use that phrase a lot because everyone who comes on my show is my friend, but I really am thrilled to have Deborah Van Treese on Soul by Todd Richards. Her cookbook, The Twisted Soul Cookbook, Modern Soul Food with Global Flavors, is one of the most inspiring cookbooks I've seen come out in a very long time. Her story is so captivating. She's a great friend, a good whiskey drinker as well. And occasionally she'll have a glass of champagne with me on a Saturday morning. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Todd, for having me, my soul brother. It is an honor. It is an honor.
Soul brother number one, you know?
Yes.
We have so much to go over, especially understanding this crazy climate that we're in of COVID still. 1 year in restaurants, we're open, close, open, close, dining in, dining out. But first, I want to allow you to give people some history on yourself, because most people don't transition out of the airlines into the restaurant business. Can you give us a little background on yourself?
Definitely. So I was in the airline industry, gosh, a total of 33 years, but I decided to go to culinary school about 7 or 8 years in. You know, since it is a easy job to manipulate, I'll put it that way, I found myself for about 20 years working in the food industry and not flying on airplanes as much, you know, just a minimal amount on the aircraft themselves. You know, I stuck with the job for the benefits and also so I could continue to travel and be introduced to different cultures and their food and just expound on my culinary world, you know, through travel. So, you know, I finally settled into, you know, let's just focus on one thing and, you know, opened up a restaurant for the second time around.
right.
You know, it's never just the first time around with this industry. So the second time around, and, you know, That's why I'm here now. You know, let go of that airline job and just put all my energy into the food world.
I do have to ask a question about airline travel and really the food on airlines, because you see this really commitment from airlines trying to serve better food. But how, I mean, how in the world, you know, and me, you know, my background is in hotels and things like that. So I understand the dynamics of travelers. But how is it that you know, serving food on an airplane seems to be such a privileged thing from class to class. And especially you look at an airline like Delta, who has now, you know, 5 different sets of seating. I'm not sure which one we're buying. Why, you know, where did the classism come in so much with food in the airline industry, in your opinion?
I think, you know, if you look at the history of the airline industry, you know, it was initially intended for the upper class. You know, it was considered a luxury to be able to fly on aircrafts. People dressed luxuriously. Everything about it was, you know, very service oriented. You know, if you talk to flight attendants from the beginning, you know, most of them are gone now, you know, but at a point I did get to meet some of those who had started flying, you know, at young ages in the beginning of the airline industry. And not only was food a big part of it, the beverage was a big part of it, and the service. I mean, they were shining shoes for customers in first class.
Wow.
You know, now I think it's changed in the effect that, you know, now the focus is more on getting you from point A to point B as quickly as possible and as cheap as possible. So some of the amenities, quite a few of the amenities and luxuries have been taken away, especially within the United States in terms of travel. You can still find some of those amenities in other countries, on their airlines. If you travel on an American carrier and then you travel on some of the foreign carriers, sometimes you do see a big difference in the type of food you're being served, the type of drink you're being served. But with me, since my history does go back, you know, I've watched food in the industry, you know, transform from, you know, the most luxurious meals. You know, I mean, I was a part of it, Todd, when I cooked eggs to order for customers in the mornings. Wow. When I woke them up. You know, it's things that are unheard of now that were taking place then.
I wonder, though, you know, it used to be where if you had a first class ticket, no matter what, you got a meal. And now, now you just get drinks in a glass, basically, and maybe about 6 more inches of leg room at the most. I'm a big guy, so I don't know. You know, I squeeze into places anyway. But it just seems to me as a metaphor for restaurants that, you know, was built in an industry of hospitality, that it seems like, you know, overall in our DNA of this country, that we're moving further and further away from hospitality and more isolated environments or more isolated experiences for people.
And I agree with that 100%. It's now, you know, we've become a nation of let's do it quickly, you know, let's do it as inexpensively as possible, you know. So even, you know, for me, the dining experience has completely changed. You know, we're seeing more and more of our fine dining restaurants, you know, go to the wayside. You know, and I think it's unfortunate because I take pleasure in the whole dining experience.
Well, you know, I wonder what we find the value in the expense. I know we can go on and on about this subject, and maybe we'll come back to it. But I really want to dive into the Twisted Soul Cookbook. And as a person who has soul in their own cookbook, one thing that I really stress to listeners and readers of both of our books is that soul is not a monolith. It is interpreted many different ways. Yes. And, you know, now having 2 books out in the last, you know, couple years that definitely have soul in the title. Really, what is the basis of soul when it comes to food for you?
I think for me, it is food that really, it comes from the heart and it tells a story. It's reflective of a culture, a personal culture, even more so than a broader definition, I think. Depending on, you know, African-American soul food, you know, we know it's rooted in slavery. We know it came out of strife and survival. Mm-hmm. But we also know that as time has gone on and our people have migrated and moved around, you know, the types of food have broadened. You know, we know that regionally, you know, we have different ways we cook things. We have different sides that we put with this and that. So it's a huge undertaking to try to just define soul food and put it in a small box, because I think it's just much bigger than that.
I would agree definitely in understanding that, you know, if you look at barbecue from a soul food perspective, that, you know, each sauce is different. Rub can be different. Pork can be king in some places in Texas. Yes. Brisket, of course, is king. But just looking at the cover of your book, and the cover of the book is absolutely stunning. And I'm working on a new book, and we're working on a cover now. And the things that my publisher doesn't necessarily think are cover worthy, you have on there, like, you know, fish and shrimp and things like that. So just from a visual standpoint, I see things that are crazy, including the red drink that's in the middle, you know, mm-hmm. of the book. But there's one recipe that really stuck out to me, and you're using manischewitz. And and I was like, okay, I know manischewitz very, very well, you know, growing up in Chicago, hanging out with the Hebrew Israelites and everyone like that. You know, manischewitz was something, well, you can't drink, but this is kosher, so it's okay. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, where did the use of manischewitz come from in your cookbook?
Definitely from my grandmother. My grandmother, my mom, you know, at some point in their lives were domestic workers, which meant that they were, you know, cooking and cleaning in, you know, a white woman or, you know, white couple's home. And often in Kansas City, in the Midwest, where I'm from, You know, it was a Jewish home. And so some of the things that they saw, you know, and you're looking at these people and they're living luxuriously, and you want to duplicate a little bit of that. You know, mm-hmm. So Manischewitz, I think, was the way, you know, one of the ways that my grandmother, you know, thought it was making her a little bit more luxurious to have that quick little nip. And she was a God-fearing woman, so there were only certain days and certain moments that she were taking this. And she also believed it was a medicinal thing. You know, so she never drank it to get drunk. She just, you know, had a sip or two every week, you know, to keep her blood pressure right, is how she would say right.
Definitely.
You know? Yep. And so for me, you know, kind of, you know, in retrospect, when I thought about as a kid opening up that refrigerator, because it was kept often in the refrigerator in the back, that Manischewitz, you know, and probably sneaking a swig every now and then myself. Yeah, right. I thought it was an important ingredient to put in this cookbook because it told a story. And I just chose to use it, you know, in short ribs, you know, as a replacement for like a red wine, a dry red wine.
As a chef myself, I was like, damn, why didn't I think of that? Like, that is so cool, you know, because you think about traditional French dishes where we were braised with red wine and port, you know,
yes.
That Manischewitz is really right in between both of those. So,
exactly.
It, you know, absolutely makes sense, you know, to do so, you know, to actually serve something like that or use something like that in the book as well. I thought it was just such a brilliant way to use something that it comes from a different faith, but still, you know, has roots in their own soul food as well. Another recipe in here that I just went crazy for it was the salmon croquettes. And the reason why I went crazy for it, it was because the stunning picture of this salmon croquette is so elevated. It just makes you want to reach in there and just pick it up with your hands and throw away the elegant part of eating. it doesn't look dry. It looks, you know, umptuous. And though, you know, even if you use canned salmon croquettes, or salmon for croquettes, or use fresh, you know, sometimes, you know, if it's not prepared rightly, the salmon can be overcooked and then it'll be dry. This looks so eye-popping, so catching, and so delicious. And then you paired it with a spring pea, bacon, and radish salad. So you have this like bitterness, this sweetness with it. What was the inspiration behind this dish? Because I really have to understand why salmon croquette and peas?
You know, I grew up with the canned salmon. You know, I think I was probably 40 before I knew salmon was actually fresh, and then they put it in a can.
Right.
You know, but and I didn't really care for it as a child. I didn't care for it growing up. I wasn't really into meat coming out of a can or fish coming out of a can. Just seemed strange to me. So I decided, you know what, let's try this with fresh salmon because I love salmon. And the results, you know, I really, really liked. And then again, traveling, you know, and going to, you know, Spanish countries or Latin countries and seeing the croquetta and the similarities to that croquette that we grew up with and kind of combining, you know, those cultures together is where I came up with the salmon croquette in this particular dish. With the peas, that was because with the canned croquettes, there was mashed potatoes and creamed peas. You know, so it was a way of elevating that traditional meal that was on our table on any given Saturday, canned salmon croquettes, mashed potatoes, and some peas out of a can. And I wanted to use those flavor profiles and then add a little bit of elevation to them. And that was the result.
I often try to eat before I do this podcast so I don't get hungry. But the way you're describing the food makes me hungry again. For any listener who's just joining us, we're with Deborah Van Treese, cookbook author, The Twisted Soul Cookbook, Modern Soul Food with Global Flavors. And we're really discussing the global flavor influences that she has in the cookbook, but it's still so soulful. And that's what I love about this book you know, so much that some of the terminology that you have, like red bean risotto, to me, I understand exactly what that is. I mean, that's red beans and rice all, you know, all the way, just done in a different one. And I'm going to put you on the spot here. Which is your favorite recipe in the book?
Oh, wow. You should do that.
I always wanted to ask someone else that question because I get asked that question all the time.
I know. And this is a hard question to answer. Mm-hmm. I think the one that always I felt like set me apart, and it really, you know, is authentic from Spain, really, is the paella macaroni. Mm. It was a light bulb moment when I was served it, and I was served it not in a restaurant, but at someone's dinner table where we just happened to drop by. And the preparation of, and I lived in Spain. Let me go back a little bit. I lived in northern Spain for quite a while and got to know some incredible people, and going by their homes and having dinner was a regular occurrence. But this dish stood out for me with the macaroni noodles, because it was like hamburger helper, you know, with the macaroni noodles on steroids with the seafood and the saffron. So I got so excited by this. And I've served it in the restaurant a few times. And ironically enough, I've had food critics say, what was she thinking? You know, what was she thinking? And that's why I think it stands out so much for me, because it wasn't my thought. It was the thought of a culture of people. And it was a soulful meal for them. And, you know, who was this food critic to pass judgment, you know, on something that you don't understand? And to me, most soul food, it has a story. And if you take the time to understand what the story is, then you can tune into the food a little bit deeper.
I agree with that 100%. It's almost like, you know, when you put vermicelli, and what we grew up with is rice-a-roni. And, you know, and it's like, well, pasta doesn't belong into, but actually, you know, it does. And it's a starch. I'm going to ask you about one more recipe, and then we're going to move on, which this one is probably my favorite, because I am, of course, a fan of chicken, but duck is one of my favorite birds of all to eat. And it's duck schnitzel and sweet potato waffle. And just thinking about, you know, this, you know, this duck, you know, with this crispy coating and in a waffle. And I love the picture so much because it's not just filled with syrup. Most people think just put syrup on waffles and they lose the flavor of a waffle if you put too much on it. Mm-hmm. But in your picture, you know, you have a jam, you have a butter here, the sweet potatoes, and then this crispy schnitzel going on top. Just tell me, what was that final, you know, the final question on the cookbook? Because we got a lot of other things to talk about. But what was the true inspiration of this dish? Because I am going to make this pretty soon.
That was, I'm sick of chicken and waffles. That's what that was. It was that simple. You know, I'm like, I'm sick of chicken and waffles. And what else can we do with this? And it just made sense. You know, we serve chicken and waffles at Twisted Soul, the restaurant. And, you know, when we do, we pound the chicken thin and do, you know, basically we serve it like a schnitzel, like a chicken, you know, schnitzel or a cutlet or, you know, whatever you'd like to call it. But, you know, the idea of the duck and the flavor of the duck and pairing it with the waffle and, you know, adding another touch. So I think we did a kumquat marmalade with it as opposed to a syrup. And just all of those flavors together, and it gave me, you know, the feel of a chicken and waffle, you know, but it to me has just a little bit more depth to it, and kind of a little bit more elegance. Yeah, when you want to have that special brunch with that good champagne. You know about that good champagne.
Yes, I do. I probably know about the good champagne all too well. We're going to take a short break here. You're listening to Soul by Todd Richards.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome back to Soul by Todd Richards. I'm here with Soul Sister Number One, Deborah Van Treese, cookbook author, restaurant owner. The Twisted Soul Cookbook is what we discussed in the first half of the show. And now we're going to just talk about the restaurant business. And a lot of times people ask me about restaurant business, but they ask me about it from maybe I think it gets colored as a male perspective sometimes, especially when you look at our business, it tends to be a male dominated industry. However, if anyone knows me in my career, I've hired more female general managers, executive chefs, and chef de cuisines than I have men. Deborah, just tell me, what is your experience of being in the hospitality business as a woman, and not only as a woman per se, but also as a leader of a movement of more women in the restaurant business as a whole?
Wow. Okay.
Well, there's a big topic, but
yeah, you know. It is. And to, like, you have to delve into my history. So I came from a predominantly female industry as a flight attendant. You know, it's most of the flight attendants are female. So I was used to, you know, that dynamic. Mm-hmm. And when I decided to make that transition and, you know, commit to a culinary career, you know, it was shocking to me because number one, I never really thought about, you know, men being in the kitchen like that. Everyone in my family, I mean, my dad, you know, definitely could cook, but my mom could burn, you know, my aunts could burn, you know, so those were the meals I was looking forward to. Now, my dad, when it came to like that barbecue and all, it's like hands down, no one could beat him. You know, but being in the kitchen, I always saw, and I came from a very traditional roles, you know, where the women cook and the men sit at the table and the women lay out the spread, you know, and we all like dive in. When I got to culinary school and when I got my first job in the culinary world, because up until culinary school, I had never worked professionally in the kitchen. I think my food experience was working at the snack bar at the zoo, and I got fired the first day they put me there. So it's like it really obviously didn't seem to be my cup of tea.
He said, let's go ahead and get that out the way. You know, let's go get the first firing done and out the way.
Yeah. It's like, oh, okay, you know. But I was a little bit shocked when, you know, I started hearing things about women in the industry, and I had some female instructors. They were very, very honest about, you know, this is not going to be easy for you as a female in this industry. How hard it was going to be, I wasn't really quite ready for. It has been shocking at times. All of the stereotypes I have, you know, I've come across them. You know, the first job I had, they put me in the pantry. Then they said, you know, why don't you learn how to bake? And that was,
I'm sorry,
you
know, I don't mean to laugh, but that is, oh my goodness. Okay.
And it was so typical of what I'm like, this is exactly what they said you were going to do. I, you know, would interview and would realize that the chef was more interested in me personally than what I wanted to do with my career. I had chefs laugh at me, you know, when I was getting real serious because I was also older, you know, I'm like, I had a whole nother career. So right. You know, I'm not immature with this. And, you know, quite honestly, culinary school, I had to pay cash for it. So I was real serious at that point in my life.
You're right about that.
So it's been, you know, a bit of a struggle. you know, and I think actually for me, it helped me, Todd, to not be that familiar with the industry because I didn't set limitations for myself because I didn't know. I didn't know. And even when I did see things happening that I was told would happen, it didn't deter me from, you know, continuing on the path that I had chosen for myself.
I can appreciate that. And wholeheartedly can appreciate that. I remember the first time I worked in a hotel and the chef de cuisine asked me, what was I going to do there? Cook fried chicken, macaroni, cheese, and things like that. And the first thing that he didn't teach me how to cook, he didn't teach me how to butcher. He didn't teach me. The first thing he taught me was shame. That I need to be ashamed of the food that that my parents and forefathers before them were cooking.
Yeah, and you know, the thing about that that's interesting is that food is not easy to cook by any means at all. You know, soul food is not easy, and there's techniques that are involved and. The processes that are involved, you know, are sometimes pretty intricate.
I mean, you know, to make chitlins taste good is it has to be damn intricate.
Exactly. You know, and that's a part of the journey too. When you know, I made the decision to do soul food, so I realized, you know, early on, okay, you're doing soul food, you know, and. Then you have the nerve to do it with a twist because you want to use that education you paid for.
Right.
Yeah. So you want to make sure you get a
with the education of traveling as well. You had a strong education in traveling. You saw other techniques or you saw similarities of our own techniques in other countries' techniques. So you really kind of bridged the gap in between your travels and your upbringing, you know, to create this cuisine. I'm assuming that's what, you know, really the point that you're getting across here.
Definitely. And I think if it wasn't for that travel, Todd, I would not know how great our food was. You know, I would not have realized it because it was great to me. But definitely, you know, coming into the industry, it was food that was looked down upon. But because I had all that travel behind me, I knew better. Because like I've seen these same things in fine French restaurants. So maybe you haven't traveled enough and maybe you need to expound your knowledge of food a little bit more because mine is pretty solid and I'm going to stick with, you know, the beauty that I know of soul food.
That is such a fantastic way of saying it. You know, our good friend, Chef Dwayne Nutter would say that, you know, his mom, you know, he went to culinary school. They were making Coco Vin. He said, oh, hell, that ain't nothing but smothered chicken my mom used to make.
Exactly.
You
know? Exactly.
You know, so we understand that, you know, given a certain name or getting a certain title or certain region that we're charging X amount of dollars more for these same dishes that we're creating. And I have always talked about how to change the poverty of our food because it's associated with poverty. But when you get down to the cooking techniques, it actually takes more work to make this food delicious in some instances compared to others.
It certainly does.
I want to talk about another part of the world of restaurants. I want to talk about a part of your life in this LGBTQ. I want to make sure I say all of those correctly. That I don't think that I think there's a misnomer in our community, and I don't mean just the food community. I want to say in the Black community that we don't celebrate ourselves in that type of realm of being in that community. And here it is, you know, I don't understand how you can be for one set of civil rights and not be for all sets of civil rights. And in this business, you know, where we're already ostracized about being, you know, Black or Afro or doing Afro cuisine or soul food, you know, there's another set of community that you are a part of. And it seems like it's become something more popular as this time has gone on, more acceptable in our restaurant business, maybe even more than Afro cuisine has from my perspective. So I just want to talk about, you know, your journey in food and in this community and how the similarities of civil rights have come about.
Oh, okay. Well,
another big first topic, of all, you know.
It's a big topic, you know, and it's something, okay, because the way you're asking, it's again, let's go back. When I first got into this industry, you know, I was a heterosexual woman with a child married to a man. With no feelings of, okay, you know, you need to switch this up. You know, it just happened. Things happened. I got a divorce and was just out here in this world. And next thing I know, I'm like, okay, now the next phase is going to be totally different. So I've experienced it, all that to say, I've experienced it from both sides of the coin. Wow. It was interesting because when I was married to a man, you know, the idea, it was just assumed that, you know, it was the free for all. It was the free for all to talk to me, you know, any kind of way. But they also thought that most women in the industry they had to be gay. They had to be lesbian if you were in this world and you were fairly good at it.
Especially if you're successful. I mean, that is the biggest assumption. Yes. Or if you can work multiple stations outside of the pantry or outside of baking. I want to clarify that for our listeners to make sure that they understand that the higher on the ladder, there's always been this assumption that a person might be XXX, especially when it comes to women, successful women in our business.
And that is so, so true. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of strange at the point where then I was, you know, with a woman. And so, yes, now I do identify in the community as a lesbian. And it was scary for me initially because I had begun to make a name for myself. And, you know, then my life switched and I was hesitant at first, you know, very closeted because I thought people would judge me on that basis as opposed to judging me on my talent. It took some work for me to overcome that and decide, you know what, to hell with this. My talents should stand on its own. And anyone who sees that differently, I don't need them to be a part of what I do anyway. I don't need them for a client. You know, I'm not going to hide from anyone who I am. It's a disservice to me, and it was a disservice to whoever I would have been with. So I thought real quick about, you know, it's time to change this and change your narrative and let your work speak for itself. It does all align with, you know, the idea of being a minority all the way around, the idea of being underserved all the way around. You know, so there are similarities as a lesbian as there is as an African-American person. It's you know, you get a little bit of all of it. And it is sometimes unnerving. Often I forget. I forget that people are even judging me because I am so into my craft. The idea of people judging me based on, you know, who I choose to sleep with or the color of my skin, you know, it constantly happens where it knocks you. It'll knock you back. You're not going to get too comfortable because something's going to happen where it knocks you back. You know, and I even have experiences in my own dining room often where it knocks me back.
You know, I truly appreciate you sharing this with everyone. And it was important for me to discuss it with you because the kitchen is a safe place for us, for all people that really cook the way that we embody cooking, meaning that we put our entire soul in it. You know, when people say you put your foot in this, literally, mm-hmm. we might have put our foot, you know, in this. You know,
we might have not to the dirt. Yeah, we didn't have a spoon, you know?
So I really, truly appreciate you sharing that side of it. And I really wanted to talk about it because I don't think it's talked about enough. I don't think that equality across the board, it's one thing to be, you know, a woman working in a restaurant. It's another one to be a lesbian working in a restaurant. It's another one to be African-American working in a restaurant. You have all these three dynamics. And yet, you know, on the other side of it, you're successful. You have a great cookbook. Everyone knows your name. And the food, first of all, the food is delicious. So let's get that out the way too. So I don't want the people to not understand that the food is delicious. So we got about maybe five more minutes here, and I really want to talk about what's next for us in the restaurant business. We are in I would say we're in a crisis. Most people won't identify it that way, but I say we are in a crisis right now. We're losing workers to factory jobs, large format factory jobs where they could offer way more benefits. The dining public, on one regard, wants to be wear masks and want to stay social distance. Another part, they really don't give a damn what, you know, anybody else thinks. And really just want to see, what do you think is next for our restaurant business moving forward?
I hope what is happening is, you know, I think we've been torn down, and we are still in the process of rebuilding.
Can you go into that just a little bit more in depth? Were you saying that we've been torn down?
We have, you know, with COVID, it has shown us, you know, some vulnerabilities that I think we did not see. We've been knocked to our ground, to our knees, trying to figure out how do we survive this. You know, as businesses, as business people, we've lost a lot of people in the business, you know, to COVID, and because it's just become too much. You know, mentally, we were drained already. You know, this, you know, situation we're in has not helped at all. Mm-hmm. We did not take care of ourselves. You know, we were in the hospitality industry and we were so busy being hospitable to everyone else that we have forgotten about ourselves. Way back when, I can remember, you know, one of the first real jobs I had was with Hallmark Cards in Kansas City. And everyone wanted to work for Hallmark Cards. And, you know, I'm sure where you live, there were companies everybody wanted to work for. And it was because they treated their employees well. They took Absolutely. Care of you. And I think we are seeing a resurgence of that in our industry, where we're understanding if we want people in this industry, we've got to take care of them. And we have to figure out how to make some things happen that were not a priority before. You know, how do we get them benefits? How do they get insurance? How do we protect them?
How do we not have a schedule where it requires someone to work 70 hours a week? I mean,
exactly,
for management.
Exactly. Yeah. Standing up and, you know, it's like our knees are bad, our feet hurt, you know, the whole nine yards. And then we take a lot of abuse from customers, you know. So I think, you know, as the food prices are going up, you know, our food prices, you know, in inside restaurants and food establishments are going to go up and even go up more so. So that we can make sure that our employees are being taken care of as well. Because if we take care of them, they're going to turn around and take care of the people who, you know, are our customers walking in the door. And it becomes a win-win for everybody. So I think, you know, we're on a path to rebuilding. I know we've changed some things. We, you know, are a small business. We can't do as much as we would like to do. But mm-hmm. where we can, you know, we are doing it. And we've been blessed that we've had some people who came in during the midst of COVID. And we've treated them so well and made them such a priority that they have remained and continue to stay. And it's something that we will continue to do and continue to build upon, you know, so we can get more people in this industry. You know, it's a good place to be. I mean, we're most creatives. Certainly. We're creatives, and, you know, we're given the right place, the right situation. You know, we should be allowed to create, and, you know, people should be in allowed to enjoy it, and pay the value of what it is worth.
I think the value is really something that I am constantly reassessing, even for, you know, my own businesses with my mm-hmm. partners. One thing that I am focusing on with our employees is that it is called restaurant business. It does not mean we can't have restaurant fun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this last 2 years has taken a lot of fun and joy out of the restaurant business. We have yes. to put that back in. And money yes. is a pathway to it, but it's not the only source of joy and pride. You know, we're implementing an Employee of the Month program, mm-hmm. Things mm-hmm. like that. You know, it's something to recognize the people that are doing the best. You know, does that mean that, you know, we give them more money? Not necessarily per se, but we might give them a gift card. We might award them with an extra half day of vacation. We might get them with selective shifts for the next month. You know, they get their hands on the priority shifts. So it's things like that that we can utilize our creative juices in order to make this industry more welcoming place, not only for just people in our community, but all communities across the board. So, Deborah, where can they find you on social media? Because I know you're everywhere on social media. Not really. You like me. Social media is a tool, but it's not necessarily your entire day. Where can everyone find you on social media?
Everyone can find me at Chef Deborah Van Treese on Instagram or at Twisted Soul Cookhouse and Quartz on Instagram. Facebook, just Deborah Van Treese or Twisted Soul Cookhouse. I don't do Twitter. I don't do TikTok. So it's like I keep it real simple.
I know, that's right. You know, you're not going to do a TikTok video together, right? You know,
we're going right?
to. It's going to be right by a green egg and smoking some ribs. And I know we're going to be in North Carolina together with Chef Greg.
With Greg Collier, and Sabrina, yes, and
you know, for this great event they're putting on there. And I'm still so fascinated by your cookbook, The Twisted Soul Cookbook. It serves as an inspiration to me and everyone knows I am a cookbook nerd. I have so many cookbooks. This one is still sits on the top shelf of my favorite readings to go back into for inspiration. So I'm truly thankful that you honored me by putting some words in your cookbook, but as well as your lovely message that you wrote in the cookbook to me. This is probably one of the few rare times that I'm in awe of someone who's on my show, and I really appreciate you coming on and visiting with us.
Well, Todd, the feeling is mutual, and I thank you for having me. I know it took us a while to get our schedules together, but it's been worth every minute of it.
Hey, we're busy people, you know. You're listening to Soul by Chef Todd Richards.
At the time of recording this episode of Soul by Chef Todd Richards, Deborah Van Treese and I are putting on a dinner celebrating the Twisted Soul Cookbook, Modern Soul Food with Global Flavors. You can find more information at www.lakeandoakbarbecue.com and come join us for this wonderful dinner with Deborah Van Treese, myself, and of course, my partner in crime, Chef Josh Lee.
Soul by Todd Richards is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization
driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of Food World's most innovative community? Subscribe to shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.